if we're lending money that ostensibly we don't have to kids who really have no hope of paying it back in order to train them for jobs that clearly don't exist, I might suggest that, you know, we've gone around the bend a little bit.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason TV, and this is the first time I think that we've ever interviewed a bona fide opera singer at Reason TV on camera. And today we're talking with Mike Rowe, who's better known as the longtime host of Discovery Channel's popular show Dirty Jobs, for which Rowe, who once sang bit parts for the Baltimore Opera and worked as an on-air pitch man for QVC, takes on gigs straight out of Bob Dylan songs, working on fishing boats, sewer systems, oil derricks, slaughterhouses, you name it. His passion these days is drawing attention to what he sees as a dangerous disconnect between the work that he says needs to be done in America on a physical blue-collar level and the way that all aspects of American society seems to demonize and push people away from the sort of dirty jobs that don't require a college degree anymore. Through the Mike Rowe Foundation and profoundly disconnected adventure between Rowe and the heavy equipment manufacturer Caterpillar, Rowe is talking a lot these days about what he calls the diploma dilemma. We've got millions unemployed and millions of jobs that are going unfilled. Mike Rowe, welcome to Reason TV.
Thanks, Nick. Did you write that?
I did.
It's good.
I only stumbled on it a bit.
No, it's not bad. I mean, the delivery was good. The accuracy, I'd put it about 90, 95%.
Okay. And that's a lot coming from you. So let's start with talking about what you see as the real problem that's cropped up over the past 40 years or so in America. We're doing everything we can to push every kid to go to a four-year college. What's wrong with that?
So it's not working. I mean, you got $1 trillion in debt on the student loan side. You have a skills gap, something.
What do you mean a skills gap?
Well, you have right now about 3 million jobs, transportation, commerce, trades that can't be filled.
And this is stuff, anything from carpentry to being an electrician, plumbers,
heating,
construction,
electric, there's a whole, truck drivers,
right.
Welders is a big one. Jobs that typically parents don't sit down and say to their kids, look, if all goes well, this is what you're going to do.
But these are actually also jobs. I mean, not only are they available, but they pay well.
Listen, yes is the short answer. But of course, you know, pay well, it's kind of relative.
Right.
What they are mostly, in my opinion, are opportunities. Mm-hmm. You know, a good welder right now can pretty much write his or her own ticket. Companies like Caterpillar, Bechtel, you can go down the list. They have had open shortages for decades. And so, you know, I talked to a kid the other day up in Butler, North Dakota. So it's Butler, right? It's cold, right. But he works on heavy equipment up there. And over $100 an hour, work when he wants, paid for his house in cash, raising a family, no debt. People don't tell his story. Ever.
So that's part of the problem is that instead we're telling everybody, you know, just you got to get that sheepskin, you got to get the college BA. Otherwise, you're not going to be happy. You're not going to have any opportunity.
It feels that way to me. Yeah, I mean that was my experience in high school, and I still hear the same platitudes today.
Talk a bit about that because you have a great story about how you were in your high school guidance counselor's office and you saw a sign that said "Work smart, not hard."
Mr. Dunbar. Yeah. Well, he called me down, as I guess you know, millions of kids have been called down to talk about my future and. He was looking at some test scores and said, look, you're not an idiot. You know, you got a shot at James Madison University of Maryland, maybe some other schools. Here's what I would suggest. And I said, I don't have any money. But more importantly, I don't have any idea what I want to do. So while I figure that out, you know, I thought I'd go to a community college, at which point he says, well, that's way below your potential, and pointed to the poster that said, work smart, not hard. The thing about the poster wasn't just the bromide at the bottom. It was the image. On the left-hand side, you've got a college graduate, recently matriculated, cap and gown, sun setting behind him, looking like he owns the world in the future. Right. And next to him is a mechanic holding a wrench covered in grease or something worse, looking down at the ground like he won the vocational consolation prize of all time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was a very specific PR campaign for college, for higher education.
And we're talking, this is what, like late 70s, early
79.
80s? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But like all PR campaigns and most everything I'm doing right now really is through the lens of a kind of marketing proposition. But all PR campaigns always go too far. And they always, it seems, promote the thing they want to focus on at the expense of something else. Now, it's kind of egregious in education, in my opinion, but it shouldn't be shocking because, look, the best way to sell a truck is to talk about how lousy the competitor is.
Right.
The best way to get elected is to talk about how creepy your opponent is. And the best way to really promote college hard is to talk about how subordinate all the other opportunities are.
And you've replaced work smart, not hard, with work smart and hard. What's the difference?
Well, a very small, is it a conjunction?
Yeah. Yes,
is it and? Is that what it is?
Yes.
All right. So, yeah, we at the time, I thought, you know, if I had any balls at all, I'd reach across Mr. Dunbar's office with a magic marker and cross out not and scratch in and. Right. My grandfather would have approved of that. I didn't do it because my father would have disapproved. But years later, I've done it. And now, as part of our fundraising, our ongoing dirty campaign for the trades, we sell posters that say work smart and hard. I now play the role of the graduate, standing there holding my degree, looking somewhat confused by the industrial setting in which I find myself, next to a far more aspirational tradesman.
Right.
So it's just another way to juxtapose.
What are the goals of the Work Smart and Hard campaign? The kind, you know, what are you hoping to affect?
Well, in a really general way, a conversation exactly like the one we're having, and a question precisely like the one you just posed. Because if you don't talk about it, the whole thing is, forget it. You know, we have to change the conversation, and we have to challenge the existing protocol, if you will. So the first thing is this general PR campaign around the trades. The second thing, there is a financial component to it. I mean, the posters are only $10, but if I can get 20,000 or 30,000 of them hanging in guidance counselor's office around the country right now, well, that's fun. And we take the money we raise, of course, and it goes into a foundation to keep the conversation going and to award what we call work ethic scholarships.
What is a work ethic scholarship?
The scholarship program and the scholarship business, as I understand it right now, rewards four basic things. Intelligence, so you have academic scholarships.
Right.
Athleticism, if you can hit a three-pointer, we got money for you for days.
Right.
Talent, right? I mean, we reward talent, we reward athleticism, we reward intelligence, and of course need. You know, need-based scholarships. Those are the categories that most scholarships address to some degree or another. Who's addressing work ethic? Who's affirmatively trying to reward the behavior we want to encourage? The behavior that the MicroWorks wants to at least talk about really redounds to two things: the willingness to learn a useful skill and the willingness to work your ass off. Combined, we think that is something that ought to be affirmatively rewarded.
Where did that go wrong? Or when did that disappear, the idea that, you know, you should learn a skill that is actually useful or in need and that you should work hard? Or
I don't know. You know, I think that's a good question for a real social anthropologist. My own opinion is just that there's a kind of inertia that most parents would agree exists, and it's the desire to see something better for your kids than you had. The question, of course, is what is better? You know, is it better right now, today, to have $140,000 in debt but a degree from Georgetown in law? Or is it better to be that kid I described up in Butler repairing? I don't know, right? But there is an inertia that says the first one is the better thing.
And let's talk a little bit about the college loan scam. I mean, because partly, I mean, you talk about, okay, there's $1 trillion in debt. Most of that will be, I mean, it's subsidized by taxpayers, but most of the principal will be paid off by the people who take the loans. But you're against the idea of taxpayer-supported loans going to college, right?
Well, look, we hold the note, right?
Yeah.
So it's whether I'm against it or not, I get a little curious about it when it gets to $1 trillion. So if we're lending money that ostensibly we don't have to kids who really have no hope of paying it back in order to train them for jobs that clearly don't exist, I might suggest that, you know, we've gone around the bend a little bit in our
analysis.
And
clearly pumping that extra money into the system allows colleges to raise their prices. I mean,
of course, the cost of a degree, and this I do know because I've read it in several reputable sources, has increased at over 500 times the rate of inflation since the mid-80s. 500 times the rate of inflation. Nothing else comes close, not even healthcare. Healthcare is like 250, 260.
Right.
So this thing is an outlier. This thing, the cost of this thing has increased so exponentially, I can't believe it's not daily headline news. Mm-hmm. Imagine any other commodity increasing at that rate. And think for a minute, too, you know, I get it. Education is hugely important. Mm-hmm. If there's only one thing that's more important than education, maybe health and fitness, right? Because what's the point if you're not functioning? Mm-hmm. But imagine the conversation we have about colleges today applied to gyms, mm-hmm. right? Imagine saying, okay, it's important to be healthy and fit. So what you need to do is spend $1,000 a month at the most expensive club in town. Otherwise, your heart might explode, you'll crap your pants, you'll get fat, and nobody will love you, okay? Meanwhile, there's a YMCA.
By the way, obviously, you've done some background research on me, so.
I didn't want to say anything, but there's an odor, yeah. Nick.
There is no, but you're not anti-college.
Not at all.
Yeah. So explain that. Okay.
I'm anti-debt. Oh. In the same way I'm not anti-gym membership. Mm-hmm. Look, if you got $1,000 a month, and you can go to the place with the shiny equipment mm-hmm. and the cadre of personal trainers mm-hmm. and the private jacuzzi, do it and enjoy your protein shake in the privacy of your own largesse.
Right.
Not your large ass, your largesse, right? Yeah. But if you can accomplish the same thing for $12 a month, you know, then I think it would be prudent to at least put them on the table. And if I have to pay for part of your membership mm-hmm. in either facility, then I might get a little exercised about your ultimate choice if you can't pay it back.
What are the roots of the kind of demonization or deprioritization of blue-collar work or of dirty jobs?
I think it's fear. You know, I mean, you've got kids, right?
Yep.
So it's got to be very scary to not have a really specific answer to questions like, what's the best path, Dad? Mm-hmm. You know, and to have somebody tell you in a fairly convincing way that there is an answer to that question, mm-hmm. that must be very comforting. And it must be very comforting to pass that certainty onto your kid, too. Here's what you need to do. You need to work hard in school. You need to study. It's not bad advice. Mm-hmm. It's just that, like I said before, it always goes too far. Because rather than put a period after work hard and study hard, we put an ellipses. Mm-hmm. And that's followed by, or else, you're going to wind up working down at the construction thing and everything. Right.
Well, now you come from a background of, or your grandfather was a laborer. I mean, he worked with his hands. He built things. Did he say to you, you know, I want you to do exactly what I did? Or does he want you, you know, I want you to have a job. I mean, you hear this all the time, where you don't have to wash your hands for 45 minutes when you come home before you can have dinner.
He was fairly agnostic about my hopes and dreams. I wasn't. I very specifically wanted to follow in his footsteps. The guy could build a house without a blueprint. He only went to the eighth grade, but by the time he was in his 30s, he was a master electrician, carpenter, steam fitter, pipe fitter.
And you've talked about how one of the best days you've ever had was kind of where you first learned the pleasures of dirty work. Why don't you tell us about that?
I was maybe 10 or 11. We lived in a small little farmhouse, and we had one toilet, and I went down one morning, took care of business, and stood up to flush it. For whatever reason, I like to watch it go away. Mm-hmm. There was something satisfying about watching something that was just in me going away, you know. And on this particular morning, it went away, and then the toilet made a sound, you know, kind of like the, you know, like that pig noise in the Amityville Horror. Just a gurgling, you know, a demonic sort of disappointing screech. And everything that had just been in me literally came flying backwards, and it covered me. And so my grandfather lived next door. Obviously, something between the septic tank and the toilet had gone tragically wrong. And my grandfather, being a magician of sorts, dug up the yard in just the right place, found the problem in the pipe, replaced the pipe. There was welding, there was laughing, there was cursing. My mother brought me my first thermos of coffee. My dad and my grandfather and I worked covered in crap. For most of the day. I took the day off school to do it. It was a very satisfying day because I was with the two most important men in my life, and I saw again, certainly not for the first or the last time, a problem, like a real problem, corrected, and it just made a lot of chronological sense to my brain. I wanted to do that. The gene that my grandfather had cruelly and horribly skipped right over me. Right, and I washed out of every shop class there was in high school, And it was my grandfather who ultimately said, look, you ought to think about getting a different toolbox.
So he was like, sorry, kid, you don't have the chops to become a master electrician, go into TV.
No, he didn't go that far. But what he said was, it doesn't matter what you do. Mm-hmm. You think you want to do what I can do. What you want to do is work in the way I'm working. Mm-hmm. So in other words, whether you're a TV interviewer or an opera singer or a writer, you can approach your craft like a tradesman.
Right.
And by that I mean like a freelancer. Mm-hmm. Instead of, okay, I need my job and my job will be 30 years and it'll come with benefits mm-hmm. and it'll be provided, blah, blah, blah. That's not working anymore. And I was never really enamored of it. Mm-hmm. I liked the idea of the classic freelancer. Mm-hmm. I always have. But you know where the word came from, by the way?
Tell me.
I'm going to, Nick. Are you ready?
Okay.
It's actually...
I'm already sitting down, so...
You know, I love the jacket. Yeah, have I said that? See, because I thought... I put my hat on, I'm like, people don't know who I am without my hat. They probably don't know who you are without the jacket.
I get that a lot, yes.
So in the olden times, a freelancer was a knight who served no lord.
Right.
He was just he had his horse and he had his lance. And his lance wasn't free, it was to the highest bidder.
Right.
It's a very mercenary way to look at the world, but it's a great way to sort of step back and protect your margins in these times,
right.
In my opinion.
Well, talk a little bit about what are the ways that you create or develop a stronger work ethic in people? Because I agree with you that apart from the skill set, you know, which is important and that will always change, and certainly the things that our parents or grandparents knew for sure were going to be the, you know, it's plastics or it's computers
right.
or it's whatever, you know, you never know. But the one thing that you can know is that if you can adapt your skills to a changing world, you're in good shape. And if you work hard, how do you create or how do you instill better work ethics in people?
I think it has something to do with being suspicious of anything that's too easy,
mm-hmm.
being suspicious of anything that doesn't hurt a little bit, you know. It has something to do with the willingness to find and take the reverse commute.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big lesson on dirty jobs. You know, there's another bromide, another platitude out there that always kind of chapped my ass a little bit, which is follow your passion. You know, my scoutmaster, my reverend, my dad, my everybody growing up is like, son, just follow your passion. It's terrible advice, you know. On dirty jobs, I met a lot of very passionate people, but very few of them followed their passion into their current vocation. You know, Les Swanson from Wisconsin, he cleaned septic tanks. You know, I asked him one day, I mean, we were literally standing up to our nipples in the most indescribable bouillabaisse on the planet, right? And I said, Les, what'd you do before this? You know, it was like 110, the sweat's running off his face, he looks at me, and he says, I swear, I was a guidance counselor. He was a psychiatrist, a psychologist. And I said, why'd you leave that? And without missing a beat, he said, I got tired of dealing with other people's shit. It was very funny, but it was very instructive, because he always thought that what he wanted to do was the thing he was told he should do. He became
right.
passionate about something he really didn't care for.
Right.
When it came time to make the change, he just looked around to see where everybody was going, and he went the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Took him into a septic tank, owned business, couple of workers, very happy.
Yeah.
So, if you're really asking, how do you know that you're going in the right direction? How do you really foster a good work ethic? I think you just have to identify the thing that most people don't want to do, figure out a way to do it, and then figure out a way to love it.
What should schools be more in the business of doing vo-tech stuff? I mean, there's a long tradition of, you know, and this is something that I think people are worried about when they look at a European system of education, where they say, hey, you know what, by the time Timmy is 12 and we've done a couple of aptitude tests, we know this guy isn't, you know, he's not college material, so
right.
Let's make him an auto mechanic. There's that level that I think people rightly push back against, but there's also the question of, you know, when you were talking about a freelance, is there anything less than a freelance system than the public school system that most people grow up in? Where you seem to have a lot of time servers. I mean, a lot of good teachers, but also it's kind of like, I got 30 years and out.
Right.
So where, you know, should it be businesses that are actually doing apprenticeships and that are building up an interest and saying, look, you know, we can offer you a good job at a good wage with, you know, some honor and integrity.
I would. I mean, if I had a big business, I would do that. I don't know that they should do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to should all over anybody. Yeah. But I think that, you know, if I depended on a skilled workforce, then I would not depend on a public education system to provide it for me. Mm-hmm. I would set up my own things internally, and I would make sure that I was doing things in the most effective way I could in terms of training the best candidate I could find.
Right.
But I do think that companies are at a kind of disadvantage because so many kids who come to apply for the kinds of work we're talking about, they have an expectation that's not realistic. Mm-hmm. They've been watching American Idol for too long. They just have an idea that, look, I did my time in high school. Maybe I even did my time in college. So where's my cheese?
Right.
Okay. Why you want me to do what? Mm-hmm. So there's a real disconnect in the way we educate vis-a-vis the opportunities that are available. There's a disconnect between the companies that are mm-hmm. providing the opportunities and the parents and guidance counselors who are advising our kids. And yeah, in the end, I mean, that's a long answer to your question, but ultimately, the company is going to have to step in
right.
to provide the training that ultimately is required.
Well, and you, I mean, this goes to, you're a critic of kind of credentialism, the idea that, you know, you can, you jump through enough hoops and then you get the cheese or whatever, and you have your own business, and you've talked about how difficult it is to hire people.
It's a nightmare.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Well, you know, why isn't it an easy thing to just figure out, you know,
because you can't ask people the questions everybody would want to ask mm-hmm. if they had to hire you. You just can't sit down and say, okay, scale of 1 to 10, where do you fall on the asshole meter? You know, be honest. Are you an asshole? It'd be good to know.
Yeah.
And if you are, look, thanks for coming by. But we already have. We have all the assholes. We don't have any openings.
We don't need another.
Yeah, we were thinking. You know,
you don't need more than one.
Technically, we have two sphincters, yeah. right? One here and one. And looked at clinically, they're identical.
That's right.
I mean, there's no way to know up from down.
So how do you get around that, though? How do you get around, or do you see, is there a move away, kind of in a world where everybody goes to high school, everybody graduates high school, everybody graduates college, it seems. Do we fall back into a new way of figuring out who's a good worker? How do we tell who's good and who's bad?
I don't think we do.
Yeah.
Look, you said it before. It's one of the reasons we fall in love with credentialing. It's the same reason we fall in love with saying one size fits all with education. Look, it's simple. All you have to do is go to college. Look, it's simple. You either have your credentials or you don't. I was at the Marine Corps ball a couple of weeks ago. I go every year. I talk to a medic. He can't find work. Now, 8 months earlier, he's somewhere over there. He's got his service revolver in one hand. He's holding the femoral artery shut. You know, he's saving a life.
Yeah.
He's taking a life. Pretty much, the guy's qualified,
right.
Okay, but he's not credentialed.
Yeah.
He can't get hired as a nurse right now. Can't do it. So the credentialing system, you know, all the C words get tricky, right? Compliance. You know, the hidden cost of compliance in the work industry today is staggering.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that, you know, the cost of hiring somebody is not simply the cost of paying them their salary. And on dirty jobs, certainly, you see, I've talked to so many employers in every state, and after we shoot, usually over a beer, we start mm-hmm. to talk about, you know, the way things really are and what are the real problems. Compliance is always a word.
And that's compliance with a wide variety of state and federal regulatory agencies, or?
Without, there are an army of angry acronyms out there, and they each have a very specific agenda. Mm-hmm. And there's not a judgment call mm-hmm. on OSHA or the EPA mm-hmm. or the SPCA or PETA, mm-hmm. but you know, they all have their letters and they all have their marching orders mm-hmm. and none of them are there to make your life easier. They're there to make you more compliant mm-hmm. and or maybe more credentialed, but really compliant. This really played out so many times in the area of safety. right? I mean, safety is obviously a critical, critical thing.
Right.
But on dirty jobs, it was really interesting. My crew and I, we sat through so many mandatory safety briefings, so many compulsory safety, it's just done by rote. Everywhere we went, from factory floors to construction sites, you'd see safety first. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after 3 or 4 years, we started getting hurt. We never got hurt, you know, initially,
right.
But as time went by, we began to realize we were becoming complacent because we were sleeping through all the sleepy briefings that the safety first protocols dictated. So I did a special called Safety Third. Mm-hmm. I wasn't trying to upset people.
What comes before safety? What are the two things?
You get to fill in the blanks. Yeah. Personally, I would put money and I guess it's getting the job done.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that's right. these are the fundamental things.
Right.
It doesn't mean safety is really less important.
Right.
But then again, saying safety first doesn't really mean it's the most important either.
Right.
It's just a bromide.
Yeah.
I sat on the plane the other day. It always makes me laugh when I look up and I see the sign that says, your safety is our priority.
Right.
Really? I was really hoping I'd get a pilot who was deeply interested in getting home to his family
right.
because he wanted to get home to his family, or she. You know, my safety is my priority. His
right.
safety is his priority. And, you know, that's just a very different
right.
sort of way of looking at a work dynamic. Mm-hmm. But the acronyms in question don't allow that to happen mm-hmm. anymore. And so the cost that comes along with letting somebody else assume responsibility for your safety, mm-hmm. the cost is incalculable.
Yeah.
Ask an actuary, okay, the insurance issues, the regulation, mm-hmm. I mean, it's on and on and on. I don't even know what the ultimate number is, but it's big.
Let's push back a little bit about it. I think one charge that can be leveled against you is the idea, well, you're romanticizing. You're in the business of romanticizing,
sure.
you know, blue-collar work, hard physical labor, which, you know, wears people out, you know, is hard. I mean, it's, you know, it's hard to get up. Your body aches, and unlike a professional football player, you don't even have a week or an off season. You got to get up the next day. But it's also true when you look at earnings. I'm looking at a Bureau of Labor Statistics chart about earnings and unemployment rates by educational attainment. If you've got a high school degree, this is in 2012, your median weekly earning was $652. If you've got a bachelor's degree, it's $1,056. If you've got a high school diploma, the unemployment rate is 8.3%. If you've got a bachelor's degree, it's 4.5%. You know, why isn't college, you know, like, what do you say to that? Or how do you work around that?
I guess I would get another graph with some other numbers, and I'd say, okay, we're $1 trillion in debt. I get hundreds of letters a week from parents whose beautifully educated snowflakes are back home sleeping on their sofa, you know, beautifully educated, but completely unqualified for any of the work that's available. I know what's happening more or less right now. I also know that, you know, the whole notion of the inverted U is fascinating to me. We were talking before about Gladwell's new book, which I really like because it's the idea of realizing that in so many areas, you don't get the extra credit. Mm-hmm. You think you'll be compensated for going the extra mile, but at some point, your return on your investment doesn't really hold up. I think that's what's happened in education. I'm not saying that what you ought to do is go to high school and then go straight to work. That'd be as ridiculous as saying what you ought to do is go straight into the most expensive school you can possibly get in and get your degree. Those two things are equally fallacious.
Yeah.
You know, that's why we talk about there's got to be a component of a freelance mentality. Mm-hmm. There has to be a new component, a new understanding of basic margins, you know? The idea that the unemployment rate is simply a reflection of X too few jobs, that doesn't make sense to me. If you have 12 million people unemployed, right now most reasonable people would go, okay, so we need 12 million more jobs. Except we don't. It doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. If it did, we wouldn't have 3.9 million jobs available right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's an inconvenient truth to the prevailing narrative, in my opinion, you know? And so I'm not against job creation. I'm not against education. I'm not against any of those things. I'm just saying that the statistics I've seen that are right in front of us right now scream opportunity. The problem is the opportunities they're screaming for have been historically, consistently, and traditionally beaten out of our own aspirational wish fulfillment.
Now, here, let me ask you this. Are you really talking about a crisis among men? In the sense that a lot of the jobs, a lot of the trades have traditionally or historically been dominated by men. You know, weren't a lot of female carpenters except on Green Acres. I don't think there was a female carpenter, before about 1970. And when you look at the labor force participation rate by women from 1950 to now, it just goes up. For men, it's going down. Is this really a crisis about male identity and, men they graduate from high school at lower rates than women. They go to college at lower rates than women. They graduate from college at lower rates than women. So is this really a crisis about men?
I have no idea.
All right. Well, that was a big wind up for.
No, it's a good question. Yeah. I wish I had a snappy answer. I think that, there's probably some obvious crossing over, right? Mm-hmm. More opportunities have been made available.
Right.
More women can avail themselves to them. I don't know that one necessarily displaces
right.
the other, but I do suspect there's a, if not a finite or fixed, mm-hmm. certainly a relatively identifiable chunk of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
It's being perhaps parsed out a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
But look, I think everything is, I don't think it's as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can look at numbers and you can look at trends, but what about the impact of technology?
Mm-hmm.
What about the impact of innovation? How are those things affecting available opportunities?
Well, talk a little bit about that, because President Obama, a couple years ago when he talked about he's good to talk about a couple of things. When during his stimulus, he talked about shovel-ready jobs. I mean, everybody took that kind of literally, that he was talking about, building new roads or repaving them. These were physical labor jobs that didn't really materialize with the stimulus. But then he also talked about how, ATMs were taking people's jobs.
Yeah.
And it seems kind of odd because, when you talk about an airplane, airplanes displaced, railroads, but then, you need mechanics to fix the airplanes, you need guys to fuel the airplanes, you need people walking up and down the aisle serving drinks on airplanes. So is technology or innovation, is that the problem here?
It's not a problem, but the displacement theory is interesting. Mm-hmm. I first read about it in our industry where, the idea was the newspaper would displace the telegraph, or maybe mm-hmm. it was vice versa, right?
Yeah.
And then movies would displace books, and then
right.
TV would displace movies,
right.
and then a DVD, and so on. It doesn't,
right?
Know.
Yeah, so that we have, a good example is how radio was supposedly killed by TV,
right?
But now we have more TV and more radio than ever,
right?
So it's kind of supplemental often.
Yeah. So, but every now and then,
yeah.
every now and then, like the 8-track's gone,
right?
It's
yeah.
gone.
Yeah.
Right. So sometimes things are displaced.
Right.
Sometimes they're just reimagined. But to your first point, the first time I heard shovel-ready jobs, as mm-hmm. a turn of phrase, I was in a water tower in New York with the guys who replace the wooden water towers on top of skyscrapers, and a guy had a small TV and we were on a break and we were watching it. And everybody just laughed at the expression shovel-ready jobs. And there was one of the guys I was working with said, the thing is about all that, he's going to have a lot more success selling shovel-ready jobs to a country that still values the notion of picking up a shovel.
Mm-hmm.
And it went right into the whole MicroWorks manifesto, mm-hmm. which is you can't assume anymore that the thing that used to be aspirational still is. You can't assume an existing opportunity is enough for the opportunity to be filled. It isn't. That really has fundamentally changed.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to technology, I think we're really talking about efficiency versus effectiveness,
mm-hmm.
which I've always been interested in.
Yeah.
So,
what do you mean by that?
I mean that if you ask any Fortune 500 company what their views are on efficiency, they'll talk very grandly and for a long time, and they'll show you brochures and they'll show you how efficient they are. On Dirty Jobs, what I saw was much more of an allegiance to effectiveness. Mm-hmm. You know, back to that inverted U, right? You don't need a cannon to do the job of a 22. Mm-hmm. You know, it's effective, you know, but the love affair with efficiency, taken too far, will have a consequence. Mm-hmm. Huxley said the greatest enemy of freedom is total anarchy, but the second greatest enemy is total efficiency. Mm-hmm. Right? And so we've become amazingly efficient. Our PDAs, our telephone, mm-hmm. there's so many examples. Mm-hmm. But the more efficient we become, the less need we have for a big workforce. Mm-hmm. They're opposites,
and
right?
I mean, now, wasn't that the dream of Karl Marx? I mean, which is that, you know, after we get to a certain point, things, you know, fruit just starts falling off the tree, and, you know, and then we get to spend all our time in leisure. But we're not there yet, or it's not working out the way that he imagined.
Total efficiency is total robots.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you want, really? I mean, so, again, it's not a rant against efficiency. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not saying slow down. I'm just saying you ought to be aware that, you know, all the charts and all the data that you have, they might be true, but what is the real context of the world we're living in? Things are happening so fast. Mm-hmm. Jobs are vanishing, and people need to somehow recalibrate in this world of hyper efficiency.
And that brings back also that freelance thing. I mean, we recognize now, or it seems like people growing up today, as opposed to maybe 30 years ago, recognize that, you know, companies like IBM and AT&T, you know, Sears, these companies are not long for the world, and the companies we assume will guarantee you lifetime employment are not around anymore. So part of your message is that recalibration. You always have to be ready to spin and move into a new direction.
Look, I think the welder is a really interesting example, you know, because like the freelance, you know, he doesn't have a lance, he has a welding torch. Right. And a good welder is really, it's a very artistic thing to watch. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's many, many different kinds of welding exist, and the people who are good at it are almost savant-like. Mm-hmm. It used to be called the industrial arts. Mm-hmm. You mentioned before how Votek vanished from high school. Well, all the press that I read about the vanishing thing from high school was the arts. Mm-hmm. It was really Votek that went first and hardest, you know. But the idea that artistry can still exist with work is really important. And when you separate artistry from work, you get the same kind of problem you get when you separate clean from dirty or blue collar from white collar. Mm-hmm. You create a gap. And it's that gap into which all kinds of things fall, you know, including expectations, including opportunity, and including millions of jobs. So, you know, I look at welding really as maybe the best example of everything we're talking about right now. The opportunities exist. The opportunities pay well. The opportunities are wildly underserved. People don't aspire to it. And yet everything in this room requires it, you know.
Right.
So whether it's smooth roads or runways or cheap electricity or indoor plumbing or basic infrastructure, you know, we used to look at the people that provided those services as vaguely heroic. Now it's not that we disparage them; we just don't look at them, or if we do, we just don't see them.
Right. Well, speaking of freelance or recalibrating, Dirty Jobs is over. What you're doing next?
This is it. I'm going to do a series of interviews in hotel rooms around this great land talking about the changing face of the modern day proletariat. The bad news is there'll be no money.
Yes. But the good news is there's room service.
There's room service.
And you can't pay for it.
TV right now, look, I'm living, as you are, in the age of Honey Boo Boo, mm-hmm. right? Not a bad thing necessarily. It's just it's transitioning like everything else. We were joking before, the Ducks have a dynasty and the Amish have a mafia, and nonfiction television right now is being hugely impacted by writers. These shows have writers' rooms, right? Again, it's okay. It's just that Dirty Jobs is a very tough sell in that environment because I never knew how Dirty Jobs would end. I still don't, really, except that it's over, so I guess I kind of know it eventually would end. But episode by episode, segment by segment, what was really for sale on that show was uncertainty. And the viewer dug it. You know, people liked the idea of, you know, no rehearsal, no scripts, no writers, no second take. That today makes people really anxious, you know, and so we're seeing a much more careful, measured, controlled look at something that should be uncareful or careless, unmeasured, and uncertain, in my opinion. Yeah. So I've taken a year to kind of look around and honestly, rather than jump right into some, you know, version of Dirty Jobs that is more controlled, I'd rather talk about, you know, some of the things I learned from doing it and see maybe if there's a way to, you know, stay relevant in that space. Yeah. Because really, look, I was lucky. I went to a community college, then I went to work, then I went back to school, I got my degree, but my real education took place in reality TV, mostly in a sewer.
Well, we will leave it there. I want to thank Mike Rowe for talking to Reason TV. I'm Nick Gillespie. Thank you.
Anytime. If you want to swap with the hat and the jacket and the thing, anytime. We'll.
Oh, okay. We could. Just a thought. As long as it's leather, I'm good with it.
It's kind of a pleather.
Yes.